Okay, wonderful. In which case, we'll go straight into it. Will, welcome to MLST. It's an absolute honour to have you here. Tell us about yourself.
Yeah, cool. Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Tim, and thanks very much for taking the time. A little bit about myself. I studied economics at Cambridge University. Coming out of there in 2012 was a very exciting time in machine learning. We saw the dropout algorithm had just come out, like TensorFlow was being released. There was a lot of excitement around machine learning. And I quickly found myself using machine learning techniques at my first company that I started, which was called Seamless Capital. And this was an algorithmic trading firm. And we were using neural networks and decision trees to predict the outcomes in sports. And then we would place bets on these predictions and we made money and it was very successful. I kind of spent 10 years growing up this very AI machine learning intensive sort of quant trading group. And then recently, about 3 years ago, I turned 30. And that was a kind of pivotal moment for me. And I decided, do I want to keep doing algorithmic trading or did I want to build something bigger? And 3 years ago, it was clear to people involved in AI that large language models were going to be a very impactful technology. And I thought it was going to be a tremendous wave. And I thought it was really going to change the way consumers interact with technology. And at the time, it was really just, it was like OpenAI had just released GPT like three. I think they'd announced GPT three, but you couldn't use it. You had to join like a wait list. And they'd shared the weights to their GPT two models. And so I really wanted to get hold of these LLMs using this Transformers architecture, but it was quite difficult to like just get it running and actually see what it could do. And I just thought it was really weird that all this cool technology was being built at Google, DeepMind, at OpenAI, but it was very hard to get one's hands on, right? And then I discovered Hugging Face, and Hugging Face had like these BERT models, which weren't very good. And it was obvious that there was going to come a day when more and more people were training their own language models. It wasn't just going to be Google and OpenAI forever. There was going to come a day when many, many people were doing it. And from my experience in machine learning through algorithmic trading was I saw a world where it's not the case that there's one big hedge fund that dominates all markets. But instead, in the financial world, you see it's a very fragmented market where each hedge fund specializes in a unique asset class, right? So for example, Bridgewater, it will be like a macro hedge fund and it will analyze the world and look at things at a certain time horizon. You know, a lot of people will hear about Warren Buffett. He buys a stock and he wants to hold it for at least 10 years. And then all the way at the other end of the spectrum, you get these high frequency traders. And their models that they're using are fundamentally predicting where this price of this asset is going to be in maybe 5 seconds time. So they're buying and selling and buying and selling very, very, very fast. And I just thought, well, this language model technology is really no different than the sort of technology we see in financial markets. Information is very essential to both. So in financial markets, you're trying to gather all the information that's relevant and to set a price. And we see that machine learning and AI is fantastic at really gathering a huge body of data and then really using that well to create the best estimate possible. And so I just thought it was very clear that the world that we live in is structured in a way that all the information, all these experts are distributed. And it's going to be a day where teams of very smart, industrious people come together and they build expert models that are very good at a single specific thing. The simplest way I kind of viewed it from a consumer perspective would be, well, maybe one day there's a little company that builds just a recipe AI. And there'll be another company that builds, a joke AI. And there's another one. And then you need a platform for all of these to come together that consumers could then interact with.
I wonder, do you fundamentally see AI as a kind of search engine or as a reasoning engine? And what I mean by that question is OpenAI pitched that they have this general intelligence. And then they released GPTs, which made it seem quite domain-specific and data-centric. Yep. So what's your view on that? Yep.
I think it's very, very clear that they operate like a search engine and not a reasoning engine. That's current, the current architecture, the current algorithms, the way they work. I really think there are kind of two camps that are excited about AI. You've got the AI researchers, the people that have been working in AI and know this space for a long, long time. And we've all seen how Tesla and Elon Musk sort of every year they say autonomous cars are just around the corner. And I'm old enough to remember when, you know, these neural networks that were first being used to understand video and to try and solve these like autonomous agent tasks. It really looked very convincing that they would surpass human performance pretty quickly. And yet a decade later, what we've seen is this repeated trend where there'll be an architecture and across a series of benchmarks, as the architecture gets refined, it very rapidly gets better. And then people get very excited and they sort of do this linear extrapolation. They go, okay, well, we're just around the corner. But actually, it doesn't follow this like linear path. Instead, it follows like an S curve, and it tops out at a certain level. And it seems that most of machine learning has always topped out around human performance. And so, with these autonomous cars, they very quickly got to be about as good as a human driver in a lot of cases. But that final just that final 5% of performance, all these tiny little edge cases. Turn out to be very, very tricky.
Yeah, and I think there's two components to that. The benchmarks are broken because they are in some way bottlenecked by examples of humans doing things, but also the way they are trained is based on examples of humans doing things, perhaps with language. And people Shane Legg talk about the distinction between being parasitic on data and doing your own searching, you know, in order to get superhuman performance. What do you think about that?
I think we need to speak about which human we're thinking of. And I think it's very clear that, like, with AI, I think 3 years ago, if you interact with GPT-2, I've got children at home, and so I always think of it in terms of IQ or intelligence of a human. And I think it's clear that GPT-2, if you interacted with that and you interacted with a three-year-old, they're kind of the similar sort of level. And then you get to GPT-3, and it's maybe like a six-year-old or something. And then with GPT-4 and 3.5 and ChatGPT, I think a lot of people it's easy to overinflate their abilities because they've really been optimized to human preferences. And so they say things that humans quite like, but it doesn't really reflect a deep understanding of the world. And, you know, we're all familiar with ways in which you can trip, these GPT models up. A four-digit multiplication is very, very difficult. And many things that we would consider reasoning, it simply, you know, it can't do a very good job of. And, you know, my opinion is GPT-4 is maybe around like a nine-year-old or something. And so what we see is we're going up this curve, and where is it going to top out? And I would guess if I had to, you know, had to place a bet, I think it'll top out around like high school level, maybe like a 15-year-old. And then we can think, well, would we deem having the intelligence of an average 15-year-old, would that constitute AGI? Would that constitute superhuman, you know? And I think for some humans, it is super. You know, like there's absolutely a percentage of the population for which GPT will be extraordinarily helpful. And there'll be another section through which we'll be waiting a little bit longer for more algorithmic innovations before it's supra human.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think language is like thought space, and there's a super organism, and we're kind of embedding all of these human thoughts into our language. And most humans are dumb. Most humans just rinse and repeat the same thoughts that are already embedded in the space. It's only the really smart people on the edges, yes, on the frontiers, yeah, who are actually percolating up new thoughts into that space.
Yep.
Yeah. So we're a little bit tight on time. So you spoke about Seamless, which is your first business, but you have now built a $450 million startup with, I think, only about 12 people. You've spoken about talent density. Yeah. I'm a startup founder myself, which, you know, so I'm very jealous. And I think you've got some very interesting things to say as well about how, you know, there's this exponential increase of friction when you add people to your team. There's the mythical Man Month. I'm not sure if you've read that book. Very, very interesting. Absolutely. But tell us about the story.
Yeah. All right. So I'm originally from the UK, and the first business I did, being in finance, is a very competitive environment. No one sort of ever wrote me a huge angel check and got me started. It wasn't the case that I was able to be in the right place at the right time. But instead, I had to compete. And it was only through being very efficient, really adding a lot of value, that the first business was able to grow and be successful. And what I repeatedly saw, I would often say to people, I'd say, if you are in a market, if you are the fifth best, you will make no money at all. If you're like the third best, you'll just about pay the bills. And all of the rewards go to really that first best and the second best players in the market. And so everything that I've done in my professional life, I've always strived to either be the best, be in the top two. And I would only ever attempt to do something if I thought I'd really be adding a lot of value to that problem or that market. And so in my experience, I started off as a self-taught software engineer, self-taught coder, self-taught machine learner. And I would start off just writing code by myself. And everyone who started off writing code by themselves is very messy. There's code everywhere. It's not well organized. It's a very chaotic thing. But actually, when it's just yourself interacting with that code base, it works quite well. And then what happens is, as soon as you introduce someone else into this messy code base, suddenly your velocity kind of halves. By adding a person to the team, the amount you get done halves, because suddenly you're just tripping over one another's toes the whole time. They make a change to the code over here and something strange happens over there, and vice versa. And so you have to begin learning techniques to deal with this complexity. And in software engineering, understanding the nature of this complexity and navigating it well there's a huge literature on it, and very, very smart people have come up with some really great solutions to this. One of which is writing really good unit tests. Others is having things like cyclometric complexity kept to the minimum. And really what you see is that when you hire kind of average engineers, they will get the task at hand solved, but they'll do it in a way which increases the complexity of the overall system. And the cost of complexity is exponential. So you can add a little bit more, and then suddenly everything is breaking. And every time you add a new feature, the app crashes or the trading engine crashes. And so in my experience, I found the only people who really stayed on top of complexity, were able to reduce it, were people who were creative, who were intelligent, and people who had very high standards and really wanted to cut through the complexity, wanted to challenge themselves. And they would be the ones who would come up to me and say, well, Will, why don't we switch paradigms here? Why don't we, instead of doing it in this way, where we have to keep adding more and more and more, we could actually flip the way we do it, have a single thing, and it'll be much simpler. And I found that whenever I worked with these people, the amount of value that they would add would... The things that they would do, time would really prove its worth. And when the moment you say that looks good, a year later, I would say, wow, that thing that you did added so much value that the whole company was able to build on top of it, and it made them more efficient and so on. And so this experience in a really competitive environment gave me a very strong opinion on how I thought this consumer startup should look like, and how I thought we should approach the engineering behind the AI. And I was very, very confident that we are in a unique period of time where a lot of people will look at the startups produced in the 2000s and the 2010s, and they would kind of see like this these teams that would require headcount to grow. And I always say, with Facebook and with eBay and Google, these guys, they had to buy hardware, they had to stick it in their garage, they had to manage a cluster, and they had to do so much work, so much heavy lifting, just to run a website. Whereas today we're able to, I can use Google Cloud, and GCP is this fantastic thing, which I would have to have 30 engineers to recreate just 10% of it, right? We're able to use a cloud provider called CoreWeave, who they currently manage our 1,000 GPU cluster for us. How many engineers would I have to do to have that? And then all of the tooling on top of it, such as Kubernetes, Docker, Python, there are a lot higher level abstractions. And so just having 12 really talented, really dedicated, creative engineers who can work well as a team, I think have this incredible amount of leverage, far, far more than people realize. And just this pressure to add headcount, or it feels bigger. It feels like safety is in numbers. But actually, if you add people to the team who aren't real superstars, it just slows things down. They create havoc. And so really, I've always had a lot of discipline when it comes to hiring and building a team, and insisting on having very, very high talent density.
Yeah, I'll just very quickly do a follow-up on this, because it's so interesting to me. There's this book called Broken Code, and that talks all about the challenges that Meta had in their growth. And of course, they had this little book they gave out to people, and they said, you know, move fast and break things, and, you know, trying to maintain that dynamism. And I think it's a bit of a cultural thing. So apparently on the Facebook workplace, the engineers hate this notion that there's all of these heroes creating disasters and then cleaning up after it. So on the one hand, you could be quite autocratic and very steady. And on the other hand, you could be kind of throwing things away, fixing things quickly. And when they complexify, start again. What's your position on that?
So I'm a big advocate and a big believer in common sense. And I think that on the one hand, we can imagine these very bureaucratic entities, big tech, where to deploy any code, it's got to pass through several reviews. Once you have a tremendously successful company, such as Google, produces a hell of a lot of money, the mindset becomes, do not break it, right? We don't have to do anything crazy here, guys. We've got a good thing going. Do not mess this up. And it makes a lot of sense to be very conservative, and you see the organization and the culture shift towards that. Chai, startups, companies that want to rapidly grow, companies at Chai, I say, guys, we need to keep growing. Every year, we need to grow by a factor of 3. Every couple of years, we need to grow by a factor of 10. We need to take huge risks. We need to be innovating. And basically, I say, that's why startups exist. If we do not take risks, there is no point in us. Big companies exist to be efficient and to maximize profits and to just pay everyone well and to serve a product to consumers that the users expect and are happy with. Startups are there to take risk, to innovate and create something new. So you absolutely have to have this push, this move fast and break things. It's so easy to be comfortable. It's so easy to wake up in the morning. Chai currently has about 1 million people use the app every day. And it's so easy to just feel comfortable with that, to feel that's a pretty big number, that's pretty good. Let's just let's keep that smooth. And then to start taking smaller steps and smaller steps and less risk. But instead, I encourage people. So often people will come to me and say, Will, is it okay if I do this? I say, look, you're smarter than me. You've got a PhD in mathematics. I'm a lowly economist. You're smarter than I am. If you think it's a good idea, just do it. If something explodes, if something breaks up, you can just undo. It's software, right? There's very few things in software that is permanent. And so on the one hand, you really have to encourage and nurture and push for this drive to keep innovating and keep taking risks. By the way, the only way you learn something is by taking a risk, through experimenting. And many, many times, you know, if we look through history, the biggest and best innovations have kind of been these accidents. So you need accidents to happen. So that's the one half of it. On the other hand, you know, it's very simple. if you imagine a really messy room, and you know, these creative people that are overly creative, it's very easy for them to create big messes. And then once things get in such a messy state, it's hard to be productive. It's hard to just do good work anyway. And so it really requires a lot of discipline to do things in a rigorous way. If you want to do an experiment, are you going to do a write-up? Are you going to be explicit about your hypothesis? Are you going to capture the data? Are you going to capture good quality data? Are you going to interview users? And it's a lot of stuff that's very, very, very tedious. It's not very exciting. It requires great discipline to do the experiments in a rigorous way. And so it's important to have both. And neither is easy. Neither is a natural impulse. What's natural is to just turn up to work and do the easy stuff, do the fun stuff, do what's not going to get you fired, and keep your head down. That's what's easy. And so push to take risk, have the discipline to do it in a scalable way, an efficient way. If the code complexity is getting too big, set that month aside, refactor it, tackle it. I think it's those two things. It's the discipline alongside the risk taking. And you can't just have one. If you just have discipline, it works if you're Google. It doesn't work if you're a startup. If you just have the risk taking without the discipline, what does that look like? It either looks like FTX, or it looks like a company that builds one cool product once and then never again.
Yeah, and I think there's a really interesting relationship between risk taking and creativity. And creativity is a strange beast, because it must be grounded by some kind of intuition about what's right, but it does appear quite random. But with the eye on the time, so you're building this exciting startup, and you haven't told us what you do yet. So what do you do?
Okay, awesome. So we started off as simply a consumer app. And back in the days when there were only a few language models available, Chai began building our own language model. We optimized it for entertainment, and then we served it to users. And people loved, they came, they interacted with it, they loved playing games with it, talking to it, whether that's for therapy, whether that's for help on their homework. And then what we saw was there was this big wave of open source. And that was when we got very excited, and we were able to kind of really step into the initial vision, which was to be this big platform, a big aggregator, where we could have researchers, data scientists, software engineers. There are so many cool people who are building language models at home, building AI at home, and they've got cool and interesting models. And we get them to submit their models to our platform. We have a Python package, it's called Chaiverse. And we take these models and we deploy them immediately to our users. And the users give the models feedback. And then that helps the researchers and the software engineers and the data scientists to refine their models, whether that's changing the prompt, changing the sampling parameters, trying a different base model, cleaning their data sets. And the best models kind of float to the top, and then we give them money. So we've paid out about $150,000 so far. We intend to pay out about a third of our revenue. That would put us in line with companies like YouTube, these UGC platforms. And we really want to be able to combine this huge array of unique and specialized language models into an experience and a single meta model that would vastly surpass any individual model.
Yeah. So we spoke earlier about partitioning the value in language models. So, of course, one school of thought is it's the model, it's the neural network. Another school of thought is it's the data. And I think you're leaning into that.
Yep.
And even then, there's a kind of partition of the data it was trained on, the data it was fine-tuned on, the feedback cycle with the customers.
Yep.
It sounds like you're really leaning into that.
Yep. So I absolutely am a huge advocate for the research that OpenAI did. Between 2018 and all the way up until when they released ChatGPT, which was, I guess, 2023 or 2022 even, they were so transparent, they were so open, and they did amazing research. And they've got all these papers which demonstrate that as you increase the size of the model, the general capabilities scale well and scale reliably. So if you don't know what you're doing, you can absolutely always increase your model and it will get smarter. But if you have anything that's sort of specific in the least, it's clear that fine-tuning the model way increases the performance way more than making it bigger. So they were able to get a 1.5 billion parameter model to outperform a 180 billion parameter model for reasonably broad tasks through fine tuning. After you fine-tuned, you would do reinforcement learning. And then, of course, you've got prompt engineering. And so the way I currently think of it is you've got the base model, fine-tuned, reinforcement learning, and prompt engineering. And you can put instruction training in there as well if you want. And it's very, very clear that if we live in a world where there are individuals who have a very strong idea, very strong understanding, they're able to select and generate data sets for a very specific thing. They're able to format the prompts, do reinforcement learning. They will be able to get behavior on a single dimension to surpass or match very, very high human performance. But the amount of energy, the amount of dedication, the amount of creativity and experimentation it takes to just achieve that sliver is not, it's a distributed thing. It's a distributed thing. It's a thing that's best left to small teams. And you actually see it already. You see these research labs where, I think this week there was a language model that was trained only on astrophysics, and it's like Astro Llama. And it claims to be the best in the world at dealing with astrophysics questions. Great. So it was a small team of researchers who built this amazing one. If there's 1,000 of these, if there's 10,000 of these distributed across Earth, how can we bring them all together to form an amazing LLM that outperforms something that a monolithic company such as Google or OpenAI would produce?
Yeah, that really resonates with me. So I'm excited about this idea of an agent framework where you can have experts in particular things.
Yes.
But it's not just the agent plane, it's the data plane, because, you know, there's this copyright fiasco at the moment. And I think in the future that there'll be some kind of way of federating access to copyright content. So I can say, well, I've paid to have access to this science journal, so I want to do retrieval augmented generation with this because I've paid for it. So surely it has to go that way.
I think it's important to recognize in my life, I've always seen that people are rewarded in proportion to the value that they truly bring. And so I would argue a huge corpus of kind of random text intrinsically is not that a valuable thing. It's the curating it. It's the fine tuning the models with the right parameters, the right regularization, the right epochs, the right optimizer. That's where the value add is occurring on the fine tuning and the pre-training layer. Then we've got this prompt engineering. We've got this retrieval. That's obviously a huge value add as well. And so I think it's very clear that in the future, there'll be a market for data retrieval. And I'm sure the New York Times will make a lot of money when language model providers start subscribing to the up-to-date New York Times data feed. They'll make a lot of money doing that. I find it hard to imagine a world where the New York Times rightfully should be able to get a lot of money for their old works, their out-of-date works. It's intrinsically not that valuable. Not many people are using this stuff, and the value is really being added by these data scientists. So I think it's important to have a separation between the two, this timely, this up-to-date information, this data sets that people are going to want to retrieve from, this prompt engineering side, and then this fine-tuning, this pre-training, which is the data scientists who are adding all of the value.
I agree. I mean, we don't have time to get into it, but I think copyright protects the expression, not the idea. And GPT has a charisma bypass, so there's no copyright infringement, you might argue, whereas Midjourney there is. But just to finish off, though, Will, this has been really amazing. What's coming next for you? Where can people find out about you? And what kind of challenges are you working with?
So currently, Chaiverse.com, this platform for aggregating language models, it's a competition. People are free to submit any model. And if it's a good model, we reward them financially. It takes talented engineers to build this stuff. If we are going to keep growing, if we are going to be able to really leverage all of humans' resources to building the next step in AI, just hiring. So if someone's a great engineer, whether that's researching, whether that's Python, whether that's just backend, apply to Chai. That's really why I'm here, is to help promote what we're doing to attract talented engineers to work with us.
Will, it's been an absolute honor to have you on MLST. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Tim.